If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Court Appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Welcome to Court Appointed, Two Dudes' Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, Tommy, I know you got an itching update here to get everybody out.
You know, Michael, I don't know if you've seen it. I don't know exactly what they're called, but I'm sure they have a name. Have you seen those martial arts discipline guys that somehow do something where they stand around and let people just kick them in the balls repeatedly over and over?
I have seen that on YouTube.
Yeah, and they don't flinch, and they just stand there, and they don't feel any pain. And even sometimes they go to the extreme of three of them will line up, and they'll tie chains to their balls or ropes and pull buses with it or something to show how strong their scrotum is or something. I don't know.
Scrotum strength is a very important feature of martial arts, in my understanding.
Is that it?
I don't know.
Well, I feel like one of these guys that hasn't been properly trained, and the government is the guys that keep kicking us over and over in the balls.
Why is that?
Well, you know, I've railed against Wells Fargo and Equifax in past episodes.
Yeah, probably about half of them.
Well, today, which it's not today when you're hearing this podcast, but it's today on the day that we're recording this podcast, the Senate has seen fit to pass a law which, shall we refer to it as the Wells Fargo Immunity Act? They passed it. It was a 50-50 vote with Mike Pence coming and casting the deciding vote that says that we no longer have the right as individuals to sue banks or other credit bureau institutions. So like with this big Wells Fargo thing that went on and Equifax thing, we don't have the right to sue them. You are forced into what is usually written in the fine print on these things of binding arbitration.
Well, I think that's horrible because there's nothing there to keep them honest now.
That's right. And it's doing away with class action suits. It's breaking it up. So individuals would just have to go to this binding arbitration, but you can't get together and form a class action suit that is really designed to punish institutions for major breaches of etiquette.
Right. It's like the whole thing you referred to a couple times about the office space thing. If you take a couple pennies or fractions
that's
of
right.
cents, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what attorney's going to go stand up to some sort of like $1.50 infraction that happens to one person?
Yeah.
They're not going to do it. If it happens to a million people, somebody's going to do it.
That's right. But once again, they're taking away the power from the people. And they say their main drive is they're protecting us against the trial lawyers. The trial lawyers are the only ones that benefit from these class action lawsuits is what they're saying.
Right.
Well, I understand that in principle that they get a bigger chunk maybe than each individual in a class action lawsuit.
Right.
But that's not the sum purpose. The sum purpose is to penalize the institution that screwed us all over.
Yes.
If they have to pay hundreds of millions of dollars, that gets their attention.
I agree that the trial lawyers do make out better than anybody else in those class action lawsuits, but the difference is it's a check and balance, like you said, to keep the larger corporations in check so they don't abuse their power like that. So I think that's a bad law.
Well, they said basically the White House's view of trial lawyers adds up to if you're on the side of the rich and powerful, you're a good lawyer. If a lawyer is representing an individual person, they're a trial lawyer, a leech on American society. That's the way they face it. So they think they're doing us a big favor. I think they just screwed us all over.
Well, I agree.
So once again, we're standing here with the government kicking us in the balls.
I'm Michael Meadows. I'm a leech and a dude.
And I'm just a dude. I'm not joining in on that.
So today's episode is not about class action lawsuits or railing against big banks and things like that, contrary to what you just heard.
Well, I know, but I had to throw that in. Thanks for letting me vent.
Oh, no problem. Oh, and actually, I forgot. I have one thing I wanted to throw in, too. We got an email from Gerardo Barba and asked to make an LSAT episode. Said, I'm interested to know how you tackled the test. I'm currently taking a prep course that is kicking my butt at the moment. Thank you. Greetings from San Jose. Love the show.
Well, thank you.
Well,
Mr. Bardo?
Barba.
Barba?
Barba. Oh. And it's Gerardo, so I think that's...
Gerardo Barba.
Yeah. So, I didn't really feel like we have enough ability to talk about an LSAT episode, just because I took the LSAT probably almost 20 years ago, and I think it's changed a little bit since then.
You think so? You don't still have your study books, huh?
No, but I did study for it I bought a book, one of those prep books, and I took a couple practice tests in it.
Cliff Notes?
No, it was just a book of tests that you practice for. And that's how I prepared for it. So
there you go. Go buy a book of tests and prepare like crazy.
Well, it says that taking a prep course right now, so that's probably even more intensive than what I did. So, but if it's kicking your butt, just bear down and get through it, and you're going to be awesome.
Yeah, and later the government will kick the other side.
So, but today's episode is going to be about jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction.
It's a word you hear a lot in the legal community and probably on TV and everywhere else, right?
Yeah, I think I've heard it more related to like cops.
Oh, really?
Than in legal matters, because like, you know, the cops are talking about how that's out of your jurisdiction or something like that for, you know, you've got to get the state police in on it or something because you're a city cop or something.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
This is a kind of it's similar, sort of, but it's kind of a different meaning when it comes into like a legal context with lawyers. So, first of all, there's two different kinds of jurisdiction that we talk about. One is called subject matter jurisdiction, and the other is called personal jurisdiction. So this episode, we're going to talk only about personal jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction is pretty much something that's always attackable, and is basically whether or not that particular court has jurisdiction to hear that kind of case. So, for example, in West Virginia, we have magistrate courts, and their jurisdiction is, in civil cases, up to $5,000. Then once it's more than that, it goes up to circuit court, and that's the court of unlimited jurisdiction. So all their matters go to circuit court. In Florida, they have small claims court, which is up to $5,000. They have county court, which handles $5,000 to $15,000. And then they have circuit court down there as well, which is up $15,000 and up. Mm-hmm. And so like if you had a case that was worth $5,001 and you tried to sue in magistrate court or small claims court, that court would not actually have subject matter jurisdiction to hear that claim because it's in excess of what the court can hear.
Uh-huh.
So there'd be no jurisdiction there, and that'd be subject matter jurisdiction. So,
okay.
But that's not what we're talking about.
All right.
We're talking about personal jurisdiction.
Okay.
And this is whether or not a person has jurisdiction in a court.
A person does?
Yes. Personal jurisdiction.
Okay.
So traditionally, there's three different types of jurisdiction in state courts. And as I said, the court has to have the power to hear a certain kind of case and enforce its judgment. Now, there's three ways to get a defendant into court. And there's one famous case that you learn about when you're in law school, and it's called Pennoyer v. Neff.
Pennoyer v. Neff.
Yep. It's an 1877 case.
He invented the Neff ball?
The Neff ball. He was the founder of Neff guns.
Yeah.
No.
Neff discs.
Nope. It was just some dude named Neff.
Good Neff.
So the story goes is that Mitchell, who was a lawyer and probably a leech, sued the defendant,
probably
his former client in Oregon, for unpaid legal fees. And at that point, the defendant was not a resident of the state and was actually not served with a copy of the lawsuit. And so what they did was they did constructive service on this person. Constructive service is usually like publication in the paper saying, hey, so-and-so is suing you, come to court and defend yourself. There's different kinds of constructive service, but that's pretty much the most common one.
Hmm.
So the defendant didn't come to court, and a default judgment was entered against them. And later on, the defendant bought 300 acres of land in Oregon. This is after they got the default judgment. And Mitchell found out about it, and he executed and had his judgment levied against that 300 acres of land and had the sheriff seize it. And so basically, the sheriff took that land and then sold it to somebody else. And it was purchased And then basically the defendant found out that his land had been sold, and he brought suit against Penoyer to try to recover the land. And so basically what he was trying to say is that, hey, I didn't know anything about this lawsuit, and you just came in and took my land. So are you following that?
No, I'm really pretty much lost.
You're lost?
Yeah. Who was Penoyer? What did he have to do with it? Was he the sheriff?
Penoyer was the original defendant.
Okay.
He was the one who was sued by Mitchell.
Okay.
And Neff was the person who bought it from the sheriff.
Okay.
So Penoyer is the one who owns the land, who owned the land and was sued and evidently didn't pay his lawyer. Mm-hmm. And then Neff was the one who bought the land and who owns the land now, the 300 acres.
Okay.
So you following that?
Yes.
So the issue is whether or not you can get a judgment against a non-resident who doesn't appear in court and get a default judgment when basically all you have is some sort of publication or constructive service. So is that enough to bring the person into personal jurisdiction into court? Is that enough notice, essentially?
I don't think so.
Well, the court said that basically constructive service is sufficient to inform the parties of action taken against any properties owned by them within that state. But since this case was the fact that he didn't own the property at that time, it was kind of attached later on, that wouldn't actually work.
Because that's like doing something after the fact or changing the law and then applying the new law to somebody after a case has been settled or something.
That's right. But now I think they split the hair basically saying that if this was about that property, the 300 acres, which was originally sold, then basically constructive notice would have been fine because the property resided in that state or the property was located in that state.
But it wasn't. He didn't have that property in that state at the time of the judgment.
Correct.
So then he came along and attached that later, and they said that was improper.
Exactly.
Okay. So, now I'm following you. Yeah. I wasn't following you before. I didn't realize he wasn't in that state before.
Right.
Okay.
So that's you kind of have to have a bit of a complicated fact scenario to kind of really get at the issues here.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of these law school questions and law school cases are about. You have these really weird facts because they have to really stress the weird issues.
I thought it was going to be like one that I read about today. It was a lawyer that was representing himself in a case.
Never a good idea.
And he failed to show up for his court case, so they rendered judgment against him. Mm-hmm. So he filed for a new trial on the basis that he got faulty representation.
That's a little embarrassing.
Yeah. That's true. He really did. Because he was his own lawyer, and he didn't show up, so he didn't have good representation.
Well, did they, what happened?
They ended up dismissing his request for a new trial.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They didn't buy that argument.
So you're telling me this inefficient attorney who ineffective attorney at the earlier level filed some sort of motion that was ineffective again.
Yes. He two strikes, you're out, I guess.
Well, that's the old adage. They say an attorney that represents himself has a
fool for a client.
Yeah, an idiot for a lawyer or something like that. So. So anyway, different kinds of jurisdiction for personal jurisdiction. The first is called in personam jurisdiction. And this is jurisdiction which is gained by somebody's presence or citizenship in the state. So basically, if a person comes into a jurisdiction, they're there, then basically they consent to be sued there. So for example, like a foreign corporation that comes into West Virginia, they're essentially, by doing business here, consenting to be sued here because they're here in the state.
Okay.
Now, the other kind is presence, and that basically means that the defendant is present in the state for court to have jurisdiction when served. So basically, it doesn't matter whenever they're here, that if they're traveling through the state and there's some sort of reason for them to be personally served inside the state, then the jurisdiction can be extended to them because they're here inside the state. So for example, in the previous case, if that guy in Oregon, if he had been in the state and actually physically served with a copy of the lawsuit prior to getting that default judgment, it wouldn't have been constructive service. It would have been actual service. And therefore probably that case would have had a different outcome.
Hmm.
So that's why you always hear stories about process servers trying to track people down and serve them and things like that. Cause you want to get that personal service.
All right. Now let me get this straight. Suppose the company is in California. Mm-hmm. And you're living in, just for extreme sake, you're in New York.
All right. Pretty extreme.
So, yeah, I want to get the distance in there. All right. So, for some reason, you have a claim against them for something.
Right.
Because they're in California, do you have to file it in California because that's where they are, or could you file it in New York because that's where you live and that's where you feel you were wronged?
Well, it depends. This is, again, more of a subject matter jurisdiction question. So it's not really the personal jurisdiction we're talking about.
Okay.
But it depends on, do they have business connections in New York? Do they do business there?
Well, they sell stuff there.
Well, then they might.
Okay.
So you might have access to be able to sue them there in New York. And we'll talk about that actually in a little bit.
The internet probably really makes things complicated, doesn't it?
It does. The world's getting smaller and it makes these jurisdictional questions a little bit, weirder.
Everybody's everywhere if you're on the internet.
Yeah. So the other kind of in personam jurisdiction is basically citizenship jurisdiction. So if somebody is a citizen of a state, then they're always going to have jurisdiction over that person in that particular state. So if you're a citizen of West Virginia, you know, you can't say, well, you can't assert jurisdiction over me. I don't acknowledge you because you're a citizen of West Virginia. So you can't deny that. So now the other kind of jurisdiction is called quasi in rem jurisdiction. Any guess what that means?
Quasi in rem.
Yeah.
That means you're almost there. I guess. I don't know.
Quasi in rem basically means as if against a thing. That's the legal term.
As if against a thing.
Right. Rem is basically thing. So it means as if against a thing. And that's where jurisdiction lies over the value of a property. And the plaintiff generally has to attach or seize the property before the court can have jurisdiction. This is kind of the not one that's not used as much because it's kind of like a hybrid between in personam and what's called in rem jurisdiction, which is the third one.
Okay.
So basically in rem jurisdiction is jurisdiction over the property itself within the state's limits. And this always has to do with actual physical property for the most part. And the classic example of this is like a foreclosure on a mortgage in a state over some property.
Now, is it only real property or can it be personal property like a car or boat or something like that?
It can be personal property as well. And that may be something that is quasi in rem as well. So depending on what it is, it may be fit in one of those kind of categories.
Okay, I wasn't sure if that's what made the distinction.
Yeah. But the in rem jurisdiction is basically over the land or the thing, but not over the person themselves.
Okay.
So, but in order to defend their thing, they have to come to court generally.
So, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You can't defend your thing if you don't come to court with your thing.
Right. You got to have your rem. Now, those are kind of the basic definitions, but as you can imagine, they've kind of evolved.
Well, sure. And this is confusing enough before the evolution.
That's right. Before we get into the evolution of jurisdiction, I think there's some motions, though.
Well, yes, we'd like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right. Approach. Who do we have today?
Today, we have our old friends from ZipRecruiter.com.
Are you in need of great talent for your business, but short on time? You don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools, smarter tools.
What if hiring could be easier, more streamlined, and less time-consuming? So even when you're busy, you could still be smart about the way you hire. If you're hiring, you know that quality hires keep your business moving forward, but you also know it can take a lot of time to find the right candidate for the job.
With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click, so you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates.
Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches.
And that's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you, it finds them.
You can even get a head start on the interview process by adding screening questions to your job post to help identify the most qualified candidates, so you don't have to waste time sorting through a stack of resumes to find the perfect fit.
So like if you're trying to hire a lawyer, you can put a question on there, what is personal jurisdiction? If they say, I don't know, then they're not qualified.
Or you could say, are you a leech?
It's no wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day.
And the easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish all in one place.
ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
So, find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results.
And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right.
Free.
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 Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/appoint.
One more time, that's ZipRecruiter.com/appoint. No, I mean now one more time, ZipRecruiter.com/appoint.
So now, the evolution of personal jurisdiction. Now, there's some cases that came along, and the Supreme Court basically started doing some different kinds of tests. One thing about the Supreme Court is they love to have different tests. So I think they like to make it kind of simple for us lawyer folks. Like, well, let's apply this test and see if it fits this criteria. So the first one for jurisdiction was the minimum contacts test. And this was kind of a bridge after that Penoyer case we talked about.
Penoyer. That's why he lost, because he sounds like lawyer. He rhymes with it. Penoyer the lawyer.
And one thing that they looked at was consent. And basically the use of a state's like highway demonstrates your consent to be sued in that state. Then also, basically, if a party makes a general appearance, then what they've done is they have consented to be sued in that state as well. Now, this is kind of different if they make an appearance just saying, hey, we're contesting jurisdiction first when they first file their answer. So whenever you have your answer in your case, if you're saying like, hey, you can't sue me here because you did it wrong, then you would file a limited appearance to contest the personal jurisdiction of the court over you. So, but if you don't file that, you just file your regular old vanilla, I didn't do that, then you've already consented to be sued in that court by just your general appearance.
Okay.
So that's why you got to be careful with that. And a lot of times if somebody files something on their own, when they get sued, like say some sort of company here in West Virginia sues somebody in Ohio saying they owe them money and they don't do service right, they don't get proper service on them, and then the person doesn't have money to hire a lawyer and they just show up and say, well, I deny that. I didn't do that. Well, it doesn't matter. They've gotten themselves into the court case now.
Because they showed up. If they hadn't shown up, then they would have a leg to stand on saying that I don't have to go there. Exactly. I don't have to go to West Virginia.
Exactly. And you can waive that quicker than you can shake a tail or something. Hmm. Is that the appropriate colloquialism?
Well, if you say so.
Okay. So, yeah, but you want to make sure if you are getting sued out of state, you want to make sure you don't just go willy-nilly running in there, because you'll get stuck in the case, whereas maybe you wouldn't have before.
Just say, na-na-na-boo-boo, you can't get me.
Exactly. I've done that before. It's kind of fun.
You've done that?
I've said, well,
na-na-na-boo-boo?
I've done that for clients, and it's pretty fun, because the other side really rams their head against a wall saying, just come on.
Well, that kind of makes me think, sometimes we sign contracts for some of our storage customers, and there's a clause in our contract that says if there's any dispute that arises, it will be governed in West Virginia.
Yeah, it's a forum selection clause.
That's where we are.
Right.
And I've had several large customers that, of course, when they go to review the contract before signing it, I'll have ones that have lawyers review it, send it back and say, change it to Kentucky or Ohio, wherever they might be located. Because we're here in this tri-state area with those places right around. So they'll change the venue or whatever that clause is to show the state they're in.
Yeah. That's a very common thing that gets negotiated in contracts between businesses, because everybody wants to have their own venue or their own forum.
And does that have to do with jurisdiction then? Or are you submitting to jurisdiction at that point?
Yeah, it has again to do a bit with subject matter jurisdiction, not so much personal jurisdiction.
Okay.
So got to think, subject matter jurisdiction is which court actually hears it, which courtroom actually will you walk into. Personal jurisdiction just basically means whether or not you actually need to walk into that courtroom.
Oh, so this has more to do with the person itself, if they've properly served you, I mean, as far as you having to go to this court, as opposed to where the trial should be held.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's kind of a subtle difference, like in the terminology, because the terminology is almost exactly the same, but it's actually kind of a vastly different concept.
Yeah, because I'm having trouble here maintaining exactly where we're going with this here. So you got to keep me on course. I'm trying to follow and think up examples of things that go along with it.
Well, hopefully people are listening or understanding what I'm talking about. Well,
hopefully they're doing better than me, but that shouldn't take much.
Now there was another case that came along, and this started going to the shift towards that minimum contacts test. And it started to begin with this case called International Shoe, which was a 1945 case.
International Shoe.
Yeah. Now, you wouldn't think that would sound like a very interesting case, would you?
No, I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, it's really not.
It's a really big shoe, really big shoe.
It's not super interesting, but it is kind of a weird set of facts. So the defendant in this case was an out-of-state company that employed salesmen within the state of Washington. Okay. And Washington sued the defendant to recover some unpaid unemployment taxes and basically served the defendant in two different ways. They sent mail to the out-of-state company, and they actually physically served one of the salesmen within the state who was walking around. And I always envision this. They're walking around door to door selling shoes. I don't know why, but that's how I always envisioned it.
Your dad was a shoe salesman in his early days.
That's right. He was at Angels, I believe, was the name of the store.
I think so.
That store was long gone by the time I came around. And so basically, the defendant appealed the verdict, saying that Washington had no personal jurisdiction over the defendant because that wasn't enough of the minimum contacts for them to be sued in that state, because they were an out-of-state corporation, and that basically they didn't have the right to sue them there, even though they had some salesmen there.
I would disagree with that.
So the issue was that in order for a state to exercise jurisdiction over a defendant, the defendant has to have minimum contacts with the state so that exercising jurisdiction over the defendant would not offend, and here's the great quote, traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. Always like that one.
Yeah.
Traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice.
They keep that in mind all the time during lawsuits.
Yep. So basically, the defendant could have sued somebody in Washington, so it was afforded the protection of the laws of that state, and therefore it should be subject to be able to be sued in that state. So that's kind of the way the court ruled.
So they couldn't sue them?
No, they could.
Oh, they could. Okay.
Yeah. So basically, if they're afforded the protections of that state,
sure,
then the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice would show that they can be sued there too.
Well, especially when it comes to something like unemployment taxes. I mean, you have to pay your unemployment taxes to these other states if you have employees there.
Yeah.
You can't just put people there and ignore the taxes that go there, because you're withholding taxes in a lot of cases. So if you're withholding them and not paying them to the proper state, you're not, the IRS will get you. You can't do those kind of things. But I think the reason that they lost, that shoe company just didn't have enough soul.
You might be right.
They were too tightly laced.
I really want to look up what kind of brands International Shoe was selling. I've never actually looked that up, and it never really even occurred to me until just now. So
I've heard of International, the truck company.
Right.
I've never heard of International Shoes.
Yeah.
They were ahead of their time.
Head and feet above everyone else? I don't know. I got nothing. I'm just a straight man. So
That makes me think, you know why the Statue of Liberty's hand is 11 inches long, don't you?
Why?
If it was 12 inches, it'd be a foot.
Never fail to amuse. So basically, the court looks at the extent of the business, the relatedness of the activities to the suit, the benefits to the employees of being in state, convenience, and state interest. Those are some different things the court kind of looks at with regard to their activity within the state.
Well, they certainly have state interest if they're not paying them the taxes they owe them.
Yeah, I'd say so too.
The state really frowns on that.
Now, one thing that the court does look at whenever they're evaluating them based on this International Shoe thing is they want to make sure that the business has or the person has systematic and continuous activity in the state. So basically, if it was kind of sporadic, like they sent somebody there to sell shoes over Labor Day weekend, but that was it, then it might not have that kind of continuous activity the court would want. And, you know, that kind of seems kind of fair too, because according to that traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice, it seemed fair if you go send somebody to sell something for one weekend and then you get sued for an unemployment tax. I mean,
yeah, well, I would imagine it'd be something like, say that it was a person that was a salesman here in Huntington. Mm-hmm. And they were to do their shoe sales around here, but they would occasionally drive over to Ohio or drive over to Kentucky and sell some shoes over there. They probably wouldn't be beholden to Kentucky or Ohio because they live here and this is their address and where they're getting paid. So it would have to be in West Virginia. The other two states wouldn't have a claim on it just because the guy went over and sold a few shoes there.
Yeah, I could see that. Now, if they
is that the proper application there, counselor?
It could be, yeah. Now, if they do it all the time, though, it probably continuously do it, then it might fit that.
Oh, okay.
So, but then again, also, I mean, at this point, these kinds of things have evolved. So based on current case law and current statutes and long arm statutes, that may not even apply, but that's a whole different ball of worms. We're talking about old school law here.
Old school law.
Yeah. Stuff you learn in law school.
We'll get to the internet stuff next.
So now there's a, I mentioned it here with long arm statutes, and this is what happens a lot of times with regards to automobile accidents. Because in this day and age, people travel all over the place. For example, you might go down on vacation to Florida and you might get in a wreck down there. And if you get in a wreck down there and then you drive your way back home to West Virginia, that doesn't mean they can't sue you or you're immune to it. They can still sue you. And the way they do that is by what's called the long arm statute. And each state basically has laws which say that by allowing you to drive on the and this is the theory behind it at least, by allowing you to drive on their roads, that you are availing yourself to their jurisdiction for any kind of lawsuit that may occur from there. And if that happens, basically what you do is you would serve the Secretary of State in your own state, and then they execute service on generally the Secretary of State in your state where you live, and then that's how you get brought into the lawsuit.
So then your Secretary of State serves you?
Yeah, generally that's how it happens. So that's called the long arm statute.
The long arm of the law.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it reaches across state lines and pulls you back in. Now, think about this. I mean, it doesn't really fit into these other things we've talked about. You might be down there for one day and you get in an accident. You don't have any of these other things. You're not systematic, continuous activity. You haven't done these other things we've talked about. You don't have really any minimum contacts with the state. You're just down there and getting an auto accident. So this is kind of very different than the other kinds of personal jurisdiction theories we've talked about. This, but it makes sense. You want to have this.
Well, yeah, because otherwise you'd have no personal responsibility.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a major extension even on what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Yep. But yeah, the long arm statutes are pretty much applicable in all kinds of states. Every state has it, I believe. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't even do research on that. I'm just guessing, but I assume they do.
Yeah. I mean, so. Quick, drive across the border. What, to Mexico? No, North Carolina.
Yeah. They'll never get us here.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't extend over here. Sure they do.
And also, I mean, I think it is one of the other things you can touch on is foreseeability. So I think it's foreseeable for you if you're driving in another state that if you get an accident that you could be brought into court there. So it's not like some sort of surprise.
Sure. Well, you couldn't expect you're down traveling through Florida and you have a wreck down there, cause a wreck down there. You can't just go back home and say, no, I'm up here. If you want to sue me or something, you got to come up here and get me. No, you got to go to where you had the accident.
Yeah, you have to kind of understand where you could be expected to kind of be hauled into court.
Yeah, that would only be fair.
One of my other favorite cases from law school, and this just had to do with the name because it was kind of interesting, is Helicopteros.
Helicopteros?
Yeah.
And is that like a helicopter parent?
No, it's a Colombian term for helicopter, or Spanish term for helicopter.
Yeah, well, that's what I figured it had to do with helicopter.
Helicopteros.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And you fly in for jurisdiction.
It's a really long arm. In this particular case, it was Helicopteros v. Hall. The plaintiffs, and they were representatives of the estates of former employees of the defendant, Helicopteros, sued Helicopteros, I'm just going to keep saying that, who was a helicopter company, as you might have guessed.
Oh, I thought they were suing the helicopter itself.
No. And they sued, it wasn't a smart helicopter, an AI helicopter.
Okay.
So
they're coming, though. They're coming.
It's a drone. So they sued this helicopter company in Texas after a helicopter crash occurred in Peru and killed several of their employees. So what you have here is you have a Colombian helicopter company with an accident that occurred in Peru being sued in Texas.
Oh, because the people that worked on it were from Texas?
Well, I don't really, didn't go into the facts of that, but essentially the theory was is that, and this is the way they tried to assert personal jurisdiction over this company, was that Helicopteros, they were engaged in what's called a joint venture with Texas and basically had some contacts in Texas pertaining to the buying helicopters and training as pilots there. So basically they moved to dismiss the case based because they said there's no personal jurisdiction here. So they were basically what happened is they were trying to have it in an American courtroom as opposed to a foreign courtroom.
Sure.
Because it'd be more
fair. I felt like that, yeah, better outcome.
So the main issue was whether or not by them purchasing the products and training their employees here, even if they did it pretty much continuously, was sufficient to allow in personam jurisdiction, even though the action did not arise with that state in particular. And the issue basically said, no, you can't do that. And so.
So they either had to go to where the crash was or where the manufacturer was.
Pretty much. Yeah. So whenever there's a controversy and it arises out of a defendant's contact with the forum state, there has to be some sort of relationship between the defendant and the forum and the litigation. So if there are sufficient contacts between the forum state and the defendant, there may still be some in personam jurisdiction, even if the action does not arise out of the defendant's contact with the forum state. Hmm. So in the forum state is what we say when we refer to where you want to have that lawsuit. Like when you said you wanted to have your forum selection clause in your contracts, you wanted West Virginia, they want a different state.
Right.
So you're trying to choose your forum. So, and basically the court determined that since them buying the parts there and training their pilots and the lawsuit itself, the reason for the lawsuit didn't really arise out of that contact with the forum state. It must be, it wasn't sufficient. So.
All right. All right. Now let me ask you one that used to come up. I think that the laws have been changed in West Virginia. And I'm probably with the other one, the original, or what'd you call it? What's the other one? Not personal.
Subject matter jurisdiction?
Subject matter. I'll probably ask you a question about that again. When I used to work for the railroad, It was at the time when people would get injured on the railroad, wherever they were at. Of course, the railroad went over most of the northeastern United States and the southeast, or most all the eastern United States. So people would get injured in other states, and they would want to have their hearing on their personal injury claim in West Virginia because West Virginia juries gave more favorable rulings to the plaintiffs than a lot of the other courts. So they don't work in West Virginia. They might work down in Florida, but they would have their case heard in West Virginia to try to get one of these favorable rulings, because their point was, well, the railroad is in West Virginia too. So that's one of their places. So they would have it. Now, I believe that we changed the West Virginia legislature, changed the law, so they don't hear those anymore. But is that a matter of personal, or is that your subject matter?
Well, I believe any lawsuit related to a railroad injury is completely different. I think there's a specific act for injured.
Well, you have the FRA that governs, you know, safety regulations on the railroad. So maybe they have it. It's all a federal type thing.
I'm pretty sure it is. And I don't know. It's something I'd have to investigate to try to determine where I'd want to file a lawsuit. It's like if somebody came into my office and said, "Hey, I got hurt on the railroad." I'd say, "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that." My first thing would try to ask them a series of questions, find out where it occurred, when it took place, who was the railroad company they were working for, where is that company based? And then I would have to basically do some sort of research to determine if there was some sort of federal preemption for the railroad for that accident, because I'm pretty sure there is, and I don't know off the top of my head what it is, but I'm almost positive. It's similar to, like, if you're working on a boat and there's like Longshoremen Act, which kind of trumps any kind of state workers' comp acts, things like that. So I don't know why they would want to have it in West Virginia as opposed to some other state. Maybe there was some sort of forum selection clause where the worker was able to choose where they wanted to go.
Well, it could be, but it was because they were getting favorable rulings. This was considered a judicial hellhole.
Well,
that would get voted the worst, and that's what they went about in the legislature, trying to clean up a bunch of those laws that were making us get bad ratings because people didn't want to come here and do business because of that.
We know that's basically all a lie, right?
No.
Yeah, because the leeches.
Oh, the leeches. That's what they're trying to get the leeches out.
No. Well, here's what the deal is. If you go and see how big the jury verdicts have been in Cabell County, Wayne County, the local counties around here, there have not been any big jury verdicts like ever really.
It hadn't rained?
No, it does not happen here. Hmm. Now, maybe in southern West Virginia, there may have been some, but here in Cabell County and places like that, it is not. You do not get like favorable verdicts.
Well, I don't think it was here. There was like one particular county in West Virginia where they would hold these, and it was just a small, small, very rural community, and they would hold the trials there, and the juries would come out. They'd be sympathetic to the people that got injured and give them big awards.
And so what happens is the insurance companies lobby against the state and want to have all this tort reform in West Virginia,
right?
Because they say, oh, it's a judicial hellhole, blah, blah, blah. They're greedy lawyers. We can't come do business here. And people are gullible enough to believe it without actually looking at the actual facts of the case. But it doesn't happen here.
Well, it sounds like you don't believe that, huh?
No, I absolutely do not. It was a complete propaganda deal by the whole insurance company.
Well, you don't have to worry. It's fixed now.
Yeah, it's real fixed. I mean, all it does, if you think about it, if you limit, like put caps on and things like that, or shorten statute of limitations, all you're really doing is hurting people who got actually hurt. mean, think about if you put a cap on some sort of injury, like a medical malpractice thing, and you say the most you can get from a medical malpractice case is $100,000. Who are you really hurting by doing that?
The person, if they were really injured, they probably lost a whole lot more than that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, that it's just not, it's not an equitable way to do it.
Right.
You're really hurting the, you're hurting the people who are really hurt.
Right.
You're not hurting the smaller, like, claims that are actually probably causing the problem. It's not a very efficient way to do it.
Well, I'm a little cynical because I dealt with a lot of people that weren't really injured, but they were looking for that big payday.
Right. Well, people on disability who might not really want to work, but they want to just kind of receive a check.
Sure. Don't we all?
And you're always going to have that in different industries.
It's like sitting around thinking and getting paid. I'd like to do that too.
Well, I don't even think they're thinking. They're just kind of sitting out watching Maury Povich.
Well, that's true. Watching the grass grow and the paint dry.
Exactly. So, well, that's me getting off my soapbox about a judicial hellhole. That really.
I could see your face light up when I said that.
Oh, it burned.
I knew where that was going.
It burns me up. And I believe this, not because, you know, it's my profession. I think, like, oh, they're trying to limit my money. I mean, I honestly, that's pretty much, I think, the way it is. So I just don't like the whole, was it the Josie Wales? We have a saying where I come from.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
Yeah. So don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining, because yeah, that's just, I don't like that. You have some other reason why you don't want to, why you want tort reform, then say it's because, well, we just want to limit what people are getting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go overboard about it.
All right.
So, all right. I don't even know what I was talking about. I'm all fired up here.
Well, you were talking about that other case.
Helicopteros?
Yeah, Helicopteros.
Well, I'm done talking about that. We can come in for a landing.
All right.
We're landing on legal breeze.
Man, you just snuck that one in on me. I wasn't ready.
I gave you, we're landing on.
Well, I know, but I thought that you were going to the next subject matter.
Oh, no.
That was
subject
it.
Matter? We're not talking about subject matter.
Well, the next case, I mean. I thought you had a different one.
No, I mean, that's basically personal jurisdiction, an overview of it. And
okay.
Do you think you understand it?
Yeah, but I'm still confused between that and subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, I had never heard this before. I just kind of came up with it when we were talking earlier. Subject matter jurisdiction is basically which courtroom you walk into. So think of it that way.
And then there's also original jurisdiction.
No, that's part of subject matter jurisdiction.
Oh, it's the same thing?
Yeah. Oh. So basically subject matter jurisdiction, the acronym is SMJ.
Okay.
You always want to write that. If you'll be like a legal expert, write SMJ on your notes.
And then you'll look real smart.
Yep. Is which courtroom you walk into, A, B, or C.
Okay.
Personal jurisdiction is basically whether or not you have to walk into courtroom A, B, or C.
Okay.
Got it?
Got it. I'm ready to roll now. I'm not going anywhere. They can't make me.
Good job.
Thank you.
So that brings us to
legal brief. See, I was ready that time. Yeah, that was a good lead in there.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe we'll edit that other part out.
Well, we could, or I don't know. We'll see.
We'll just leave it there.
See what the time range is.
Okay, so the first term is subject matter jurisdiction. What is it?
That has to do with what court has jurisdiction over your situation, which area.
That's right. And how is that different than personal jurisdiction?
Personal jurisdiction has to do with whether you have to walk into that courtroom personally or not, or if it's in the wrong place and you don't have to go. So don't go, because if you show up, then you're screwed. Then you got to show up the next time.
That's right. Now, there's three different kinds of jurisdiction we talked about that are the basic kind. Mm-hmm. In personam jurisdiction.
In personam.
And then there's quasi in rem.
And in rem.
And what's the difference between those?
Well, personam has to do with the person personally where they have to show up.
Mm-hmm.
In rem has to do with like property and where it's at. Is it located within the jurisdiction of the court to have a ruling over it?
Right.
And quasi in rem has to do with other parts of other property or something that can be attached to it or something.
Yeah, it kind of has to do with like the value of the property. So it's kind of dealing with the property, but it's more about the value of the property.
Okay.
So, but I think that's a good answer, though. You pretty much nailed that one.
Well, I was listening. I had those three written down, too.
Oh, did you take some notes?
Yeah. See, unlike you, I read my notes. Unlike you with your robot one.
Now, what does NREM actually mean? Or what does REM actually mean?
Thing.
You're right.
Jurisdiction over the thing.
You're passing all your...
Are we talking about that big rock creature from Marvel Comics?
The thing? No, we're not.
Oh, okay. But I'd like to have jurisdiction over him. Tell him, go crush, kill, destroy.
Now...
Go kill Wells Fargo. Equifax while you're at it. If you see him on the way.
Now, can you remember the names of the cases I spoke about? There was three cases.
Well, there's Helicopteros.
That's right.
Somebody versus Helicopteros. There was the International Shoe Company.
That's right.
Washington versus the International Shoe Company or something like that.
Yep. And what was the first one?
The first one was the guy that sounded like lawyer, like Poyer or something like that.
Pennoyer v.
Yeah. With the Neff football.
Yep. And those are the big three cases when it comes to talking about jurisdiction and learning about them in law school.
How did I never hear them before? I guess I didn't go to law school.
You didn't go to law school.
That's why I'm only a dude.
In case no one knew.
In case they hadn't guessed by now. I wasn't there in personam.
You were not there in personam. You were quasi.
I was quasi sober.
Quasi sober. You were quasi sober during your business law class you took?
That's right. Whenever it wasn't a blood giving day and happy hour at the varsity.
Plasma?
No, blood. They would have those blood drives, and then we'd go to happy hour at the varsity, and you could drink one small pitcher and be looped because you're a pint low.
That sounds medically safe.
That sounds medically solid reasoning.
You need to ask Sydney about that to make sure.
You're replacing, you know, 1/16 of your fluids with beer.
Well, do you have any questions about jurisdiction in general?
Absolutely.
Do you want to ask me those questions?
No, I mean, I don't have any. I have a lot of, I'm still confusing the two there as far as which is which. So what my recommendation is, if anything comes up, call a lawyer before you do anything.
Jurisdiction is a bit more of a confusing topic. And when you study in law school, this is something you actually spend weeks on kind of learning. So to be able to condense it into a short podcast is probably a little hard, but it gives you a bit of an overview.
Oh, I understand it better now than I did before we started.
Yeah.
Because I read some of this stuff, so I just have some idea of what we were talking about, and I read it, and I thought I was reading in circles.
And you understand why maybe us leeches need to figure out where we're supposed to go with these things.
Yeah, if you don't put the leeches where they belong, no telling what they'll suck.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.